From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter Rodell.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And right now we're watching the comings and goings in New York as the Trump transition team readies for more appointments and meets with the New York Times today. We're going to speak with NPR's David Folkenflik to catch up in just a minute.
Yeah, the president-elect is also conducting some business of his own, and that's raising red flags. Since Election Day, Trump has met with Indian real estate developers who have ties to Trump-branded properties. He's also met with a prominent British politician where the topic of wind farms came up, which could affect Trump's golf club in Scotland. Now, Trump has said he'll remove himself from the day-to-day operations of his global empire, but can he? Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've gone through and you've counted just how deep Donald Trump's international business ties are. What did you find?
Well, we found that at least 120 of the 584 companies he's disclosed have chiefly international business as their mission.
And what's the significance of that?
Well, it suggests that his business entanglements are going to be much broader than people at first envisioned. Some of these companies were added during the campaign, for instance, in Saudi Arabia. It suggests that the conduct of foreign policy is going to be very open to potential conflicts of interest unless he completely divorces himself from his business.
Now, let's dig into that, because there are some concerns as these stories come out. We have Ivanka Trump sitting in on the meeting with Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister. You have Donald Trump meeting with Indian businessmen who have ties to a Trump-branded property in India. You've now got this story that Trump met with Nigel Farage after the election and encouraged him to oppose these wind turbine projects in the UK. To a lot of people, this feels uncomfortable, but is he walking a dangerous line legally speaking?
Well, legally speaking, I think we're somewhat in uncharted territories. I do think that until he takes office, you can make an argument that, well, he's tying up his loose ends before he hands it off to either a blind trust or a family trust or however he's going to arrange it, but we really don't have a precedent for anybody who's had this sort of holdings. Mitt Romney might have had some of these same issues, but in terms of people who've been in office, it's been more holding investments. Like Dick Cheney had a lot of investments, and Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, former Goldman Sachs guy, also had a lot of holdings that he did put in a blind trust.
Well, there's also this clause in the Constitution. Now, it is obscure, but people are talking about it now. It's called the Foreign Emoluments Clause. It says no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present of any kind whatsoever from a foreign state. That's some paraphrasing going on there. But do you see any potential for trouble there? You counted how many ties he had with foreign businesses. Are any of them controlled by foreign states?
Well, we don't know, frankly, how they're controlled. We know that the overwhelming majority of them, more than roughly 380 of them, are in Delaware. They're limited liability companies, which have to declare almost nothing in terms of their structure and their ownership structure. So, for example, we don't know on a lot of these overseas ventures whether or not his partners are actually co-owners. In a real technical way, a foreign owner would then have to file what's called an FBAR. It's an IRS form in which they would have to declare, even if they did not earn their profits in the United States, if they had an overseas business with Mr. Trump. The IRS might know that, but the rest of us wouldn't.
Mm. Well, Donald Trump tweeted today that prior to the election, it was well known that he had interest in properties all over the world. He said only the crooked media makes this a big deal. And Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway said this in the lobby of Trump Tower yesterday.
I'm very confident he's not breaking any laws. He has many lawyers, accountants, and advisors who tell him what he must do and what he can't do. And he's a businessman. He is also working a transition. He's the president-elect. And, you know, we're in unprecedented times.
And so, Kevin, you know, she has a point. You made it that we've never had a president that's been so linked to businesses in the way that Donald Trump is. Now, there is growing pressure for Trump to put his holdings in a blind trust. Is that going to solve his problems?
It depends on how you structure it. The way he's talked about it publicly doesn't sound like he's actually thinking about a blind trust. A blind trust would be completely divorcing himself from his assets, and his family wouldn't be involved in running his business either. He'd have somebody else basically tending to his business. And even then, you still wouldn't know whether or not decisions benefit him or hurt him. And, you know, a lot has been focused on how he might benefit, but the other part of this is how people who've co-invested with him or who have invested in projects that have his name on it, how that name now may work against them if his presidency doesn't work, or if there are any controversy with any of these host countries where he has properties. Then suddenly he could face lawsuits from people who claim they had bought into a property with his name on it and somebody's removed the name. He has the right to remove his name from buildings. So there's just a whole can of worms.
Is there a role that Congress is going to have to play here to help sort this out?
Hard to say. I mean, they're in the same boat. How do you distinguish what a conflict of interest is when you don't even know the structure of these companies? It's not like a publicly traded company, Apple or General Motors, where you've got quarterly reports and earnings reports. We know nothing about these companies, which is nothing illegal. They're privately held companies, but it just makes it that much harder to understand what a potential conflict would be.
We're in uncharted territory. Kevin Hall, chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Well, as we said, President-elect Trump's meeting with the New York Times is back on again. Earlier this morning, Trump had tweeted, "I canceled today's meeting with the failing New York Times when the terms and conditions of the meeting were changed at the last moment. Not nice." The Times then said that's the first they'd heard of the cancellation and contradicted his version of events, saying the Times had not changed the terms of the meeting. A few hours later, it was back on. But relations with the press certainly are not. Yesterday, what is traditionally a Q&A between a president-elect and the press turned into a tongue-lashing by Trump, who, according to The New Yorker, railed about dishonest coverage. When asked about fake news on social media, he said it was the networks spreading fake news. CNN, liars. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is with us. David, take just a brief minute on the New York Times story. What happened?
Well, what didn't happen? I've seen you've been at a carousel. The horse rides away from you, and then it comes galloping right back. In this case, literally, as I was in studio waiting to talk to Steve Inskeep this morning on Morning Edition, he tweeted before dawn, did Donald Trump, that he had canceled it. They were changing the terms and conditions of the event. And it turned out that, according to the Times, what they told me was that they had two sessions, a brief off-the-record session with executives. Then there was going to be a longer one on the record with the newspaper's columnists, reporters, editors, where he'd take questions on the record. But he said, you know, this wasn't nice of them to do. And then Trump later, about 30 minutes later, about 6:45 this morning Eastern Time, tweeted that the Times had been unfair and nasty in its coverage toward him. Maybe a meeting would be possible later. And I think that's telling only because the Times, in a sort of understated story on the front page above the fold this morning, published a story you can still find online, of course, that, you know, made strong case for the idea that Trump's vast international holdings abroad, because they relied on a lot of deals with foreign powers, could violate a key clause of the Constitution, and that you know, lawyers and ethicists and scholars were looking at this and saying this is going to be a really tough one to get around because the holdings are so integral to his fortune. So Trump may not have wanted in some ways this morning, seeing that story, not to go to the Times and then face questions on the record about this problematic story for him.
Well, and is this, you know, crazy like a fox? Because, and we've said this often in our conversations, because a lot of the copy and airtime has been consumed by his tongue lashing of the anchors last night or his, you know, spat with the New York Times. And not, you know, we're not hearing the reporting, as we just did, you know, we should say on our program, about the questions about the business holdings, or we're not hearing about his private foundation, which might have violated regulations.
Well, I think there are key stories. There's the question just in the last 24 hours to 72 hours. There's a story about the foreign holdings. There's the question, the new tax forms turned up by an intrepid reporter for The Washington Post. It seems to show that he's disclosing he did violate tax law in that prohibits somebody from getting enriched or his family or friends being enriched from the proceedings of a charity, the Trump Foundation. And another story about, you know, the $25 million payment that Donald Trump is doing to settle these lawsuits by many people in different states against Trump University in which they claimed they were defrauded. Trump is paying a significant amount of money to make that go away. That's a pretty embarrassing, devastating admission for a president-elect, and yet it seemed to fade from the headlines relatively quickly. It's not that the press can't cover these things. It's that Trump forces them to cover other things right through his sort of instinctual use of tweets and also absorbs all the oxygen on social media for outrages such as his reaction to comments by the cast of Hamilton Hamilton last week toward Vice President Pence.
Look, his supporters are probably applauding. In fact, we've heard from them that they are applauding his treatment of what they see as East Coast elites in the press. But is this a president who doesn't need the press? He has both Steve Bannon, who used to run Breitbart News and has ties with it still, and Roger Ailes, former chair of Fox News. They talked about having their own media together. Does he not need the mainstream press?
I think he wants the mainstream press. I mean, if you take yesterday's meeting with TV executives and anchors, Trump invited them into Trump Tower. They were photographed. All these famous anchors, you know, people we know well in our living rooms were photographed walking through the lobby of Trump Tower. And he wanted to court them and to establish some kind of rapport. But he did dress them down for about 15 minutes in a couple of ways. In one way, he said to CNN, "You're terribly unfair to me. You know, you've been unfair." He's saying this to the head of CNN, Jeff Zucker, with whom he used to have a business relationship when Zucker was a senior NBC executive. And yet he leaks that so people know it. And yet at the same time, he wants to impress them with his knowledge of policy and his implications of what he wants to do as president. So it's this duality that Trump is showing there.
Going to be interesting 4 years. NPR media correspondent David Fogenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Director Robert Zemeckis won an Oscar for his work on Forrest Gump. He's also the director of the classic Back to the Future films. But in his new project, Zemeckis explores a time period that's new to him. Allied stars Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard, spies who meet in Casablanca during World War II. Their mission is to pose as husband and wife to assassinate a German ambassador at a party.
The guns will be taped under the champagne table. The ambassador arrives at precisely 8:30.
If he's late?
He's German. He'll be on time.
Now, it gets complicated when Max and Marianne betray the common sense of their industry. They fall in love and marry. And things get really complicated when Marianne is suspected of being a German double agent. Allied opens in theaters tomorrow, and Robert Zemeckis joins us now from New York. Robert, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, we've read that doing a film set during World War II is actually something you've been meaning to do for a long time. Why is that?
Well, I grew up watching World War II movies, watching World War II television shows. It was something that I became a amateur World War II historian. Something that was a historical time that always appealed to me and I was interested in. So when this project came along, I thought, this will be fun.
Did those TV shows and films from your childhood influence this film?
Well, I don't know if they were very different. I mean, because those were mainly films, you know, the ones I was watching as a little kid were – they had a lot of action, a lot of battles and things like that. But this film's mainly – World War II is the backdrop. I mean, this is mainly a romance set in World War II. So I guess it helped me just sort of know what things should look like and, I don't know, certain phraseology, terminology, uniforms, things like that.
Yeah, well, let's play a scene from the movie. Here's Brad Pitt's character, Max, when he's confronted by his boss, played by the great Jared Harris, who some of us might know from Lane Price on Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And Max has just been told that Marianne, his wife, is a German spy.
My wife is not a spy.
If she is, we need to keep her in place for 72 hours so that we can identify her handler and clean out the rest of her circuit. No.
Now, Stephen Knight, who wrote the screenplay, says that this was inspired by a true story and that, in fact, this sort of nightmare scenario actually happened in real life. Is that right?
That's what he told me. I haven't found any actual documentation of it, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen because it all happened in the world of secret agents and things like that.
And the hardest thing about the situation that Max is in is that if, in fact, his wife is a spy, he will have to kill her with his own hands. And I think that gets us to a part of the theme of the film, which is that sometimes anyone who's ever been married might have confronted the fact that we don't really maybe know exactly who it is that we've fallen in love with.
Exactly right. And I think that's the universal idea, the universal theme, if you will, the thing that makes it a story that everyone can identify with. Obviously the World War II setting raises the stakes, but the underlying idea that you may not know exactly who you're married to is a very common idea, universal idea.
And watching the film, I felt this sort of underlying sense of foreboding or doom to come. I mean, I imagine you were playing with our emotions a little bit there.
Yeah, it was done consciously. I mean, I think that you very subtly get a sense that maybe this isn't going to end well. And you get this feeling that, you know, these two people who are obviously very passionately in love, there's something just not quite right.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from the film. Here's a scene at that party where they're supposed to be planning their assassination of the ambassador. Max whispers to Marianne that the ambassador could be late, which could throw off the entire mission. Let's listen to that.
Il est en retard. Qu'est-ce qu'il fait?
Okay, so that was in French.
I played
that because here we have Brad Pitt speaking a lot of French. What kind of extra effort did that take?
Well, he worked really hard on that, and you know, and he had a really and it was great because Marianne helped him the whole time, and you know, and she
native French speaker.
Yeah, and she, you know, and she wanted him to speak, you know, perfect Parisian French, which his character is supposed to do. So she was pretty hard on him, but I can't speak French, so I had to rely on all of our technical advisors and, of course, Marianne and Brad, but he did a really good job.
When you're shooting a scene with actors who don't speak the language they're trying to speak, how many takes do you have to do?
You do the same amount as if they're speaking English. I mean, you have one more person who has to weigh in, which is the – like I said, whoever the language dialogue coach is, French-speaking dialogue coach. I'll do a take and it feels good performance-wise, and then I'll look back at the dialogue coach and he'll say, well, you know, he kind of missed this little word and this little thing and this thing here, and so we have to do another one, and we'll do it again. And it's just like doing a take in your native language. You just have one more thing that you have to do.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, this film has a really old Hollywood feel to it, the way it looks. In fact, the first quarter of it takes place in Casablanca, which – I don't know. It feels like it could be an homage to the classic film. Was that deliberate?
Well, you know, the script was set in Casablanca, and it's important to the story. And I mean, obviously, the film Casablanca is such an iconic film that anytime another movie set in that era, which is the 1940s, is in Casablanca, it's going to feel like a homage. But it was important to the story because, you know, when we did the research and I read the screenplay, you know, Casablanca in the early 40s was really exactly like the movie Casablanca. It was full of spies and shady characters, and there was a lot going on there. Mm. And it was also a very glamorous place because it was considered to be the Riviera of North Africa, and it had a very sophisticated, you know, French influence. And so it was very much like the actual movie. So it feels like a homage, but we were presenting it very accurately.
Your resume is filled with films that have become classics. Let's listen to this.
My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
Rhodes. Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Okay, you know this very well, but for those who don't, that was Back to the Future that we just heard. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And, of course, Forrest Gump. Robert Zemeckis, what is it about those movies that you made that made them so great?
I'm probably the last person who can answer that question. You know, I was just doing the best I could to make the movie, you know, work and enjoyable and entertaining. You know, I guess if I were to really, you know, be honest about it and break it down, I think it's because they're, you know, they're characters that are endearing and timeless. I really believe that that's the thing that, you know, would make a film sort of last for decades and stay in the pop culture mentality of the
Marty McFly and people like Forrest Gump.
And people like Forrest Gump, but you know, I mean sort of the you know, the innocence of Forrest is something that's very charming and very lovable and people identify with. Plus there's also, you know, Forrest Gump has a lot of the theme in Forrest Gump are all different sorts of love. You know, it's love of a mother for a child, a love of two deep friends with, you know, Forrest and Lieutenant Dan's, you know, relationship and, you know, obviously the romantic story between Forrest and Jenny. And, as, you know, so there's a lot of universal themes in that movie, of course.
Yeah. And when you're making a film, do you have a sense that this one will become a classic or does it sometimes surprise you after it comes out?
No, I think, I don't know, you can never know that. All you ever all you ever hope for is that, you know, people, you know, will go to the movie, and you can't – no one can ever know that or feel that in the process as something that happens after the fact. And that's why I said I'm probably the last person who could ever actually explain why these films have lasted as long as they have. That's something I think that film scholars will have to do.
Among your long list of films, where do you think Allied will end up?
I have no idea. I think that people who go see the movie are going to really have a really entertaining time. And it's a story about an incredibly passionate love story between two people, which is something that is a rarity in the filmscape these days. So it's something that is not seen for – has not been seen for a while. And I think people will enjoy it if they go see it. Now, whether it's going to last after, you know, the opening weekend or not, I have no idea.
Now, that's going to be stressful as a filmmaker.
Well, that's the way, you know, that's the way the movie business has always been. You know, it's a very risky venture. You know, it's what makes it very nerve-wracking and at the same time very exhilarating.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you before we go, because earlier this fall, the film Allied became the focus of rumors when Brad Pitt's marriage to Angelina Jolie was breaking up. Now, I don't want to go into it at all. I don't really care about that. But the rumor was that Marion Cotillard was a possible cause. She's publicly denied it. I want to know from you whether you're frustrated by this sort of distraction in Hollywood when you're all you're doing here is trying to make a film, to put it out, to have people go out and watch it, and all of a sudden there's this drama around it. Does that frustrate you?
Well, it's very frustrating, and it's very disrespectful to all the people who are involved, you know, because it takes the focus off of what we're trying to do with the movie, and it becomes this thing about celebrity rather than the work that these two magnificent actors did in the piece.
Do you have to address that with your staff?
There's not really a lot we can do. I mean, the only way I know how to address it is to put the movie out in front, you know, and let the movie speak for itself.
Robert Zemeckis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
And one of my favorite stories of all time was about an earnest group of people who'd gather on unlit rainy roads on a certain day in the spring in western Massachusetts to walk the spotted salamander across the street. Now, the humans would fling themselves in the path of traffic while the yellow and black creatures would lumber across in a ritual far older than the road. Well, now there's a tunnel for them, and it's part of a growing movement around the world to engineer ways for wild animals to cross roads. Vicki Croak covers all things animal for Here and Now. She joins us. And Vicki, what other creatures are we talking about?
Hey, Robin. Well, globally, everything from elephants in Kenya to little blue penguins waddling through a brand new 80-foot-long tunnel in New Zealand. In Russia, close to the border with China, a tunnel about a third of a mile long was opened earlier this year. So while traffic speeds along inside, on top there's a swath of forest that bridges the space for tigers and leopards. In North America, we've got culverts under Interstate 75 for cougars in Florida. A big double archway overpass is being built right now on Interstate 90 in the state of Washington. It's part of a larger highway improvement project. And it'll be that state's first highway overpass for wildlife. That one's for deer, elk, bears, I'm sure squirrels.
Yeah.
Further north in Banff National Park in Canada, that is a really effective series of highway mitigation structures across the Trans-Canada Highway. And overpasses, underpasses, grizzly bears, black bears, lynx, moose, mountain lions, wolves all use them.
Now, see, I can hear someone saying, well, what? But this is about more than what you might think. For instance, it's about reducing collisions with these animals, which can be disastrous. But what else?
So, yeah, that's right. There's safety for nearby animals and humans. But the work in Banff is really a great example of this concept of conservation connectivity. It's paying special attention to large-scale movements of animals, migration corridors, making sure populations of animals are not cut off from mates or resources. And I spoke with Harvey Locke. He's a founder and strategic advisor to Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. It's a joint Canada-U.S. nonprofit, an ambitious project that works collaboratively with lots of groups and scientists to give animals the space to roam. And he explained why Banff is a model that others emulate.
It's been remarkably successful, and it's reduced the roadkill rate something like 90%. But more importantly, what it's done is it's stopped this highly valued national park landscape from being cut in two by this highway that goes across it, and rather allowing the system to still have habitat that's useful on either side of the road instead of splitting the park in two.
Right. But Vicki, how do animals know to use it?
That's a great question. They're sighted usually where animals are crossing or trying to cross already, and then fencing helps funnel them to the structure. Pretty famously, a few years ago in western Wyoming, migrating pronghorn actually started using a wildlife overpass before it was finished. The overpass was up, but the soil hadn't been put down. Years of science, planning, and mapping go into these things before they're built. And John Beckman is a scientist who's worked a lot on this, including that pronghorn project. He's the connectivity initiative coordinator for the Wildlife Conservation Society's North America program. He says it's a growing movement. There are hundreds of mitigation projects of all kinds for all kinds of species in the United States, and the numbers growing. Mm-hmm. Prey animals tend to like the overpasses, and stealthy predators tend to like the underpasses.
And so we can keep them separate, maybe, in that way. Well, you know, we do want infrastructure. Vicki Croak, host of the Wildlife Blog. And we'll have links to more about animal crossings at hereandnow.org. And let's applaud the people who have been doing it for years, helping the creatures get across the road. Vicki, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And it's football and marching band season. So what does it take to become the best high school marching band in the country, the kind that might be picked to march in the inaugural parade? Well, to find out, Here and Now's Lynn Menegon went to Trumbull, Connecticut, home of the Trumbull High School Golden Eagles Marching Band, and she discovered that what it takes is a village, but it also helps to have a very large truck.
So you're wearing a button on your hat that says Marching Band Dad.
Yes.
Tell me your name.
Michael Noe.
And we're looking at a big black tractor trailer truck. So there's a lot of gear involved here.
There is really a lot of gear. All the bands, all the uniforms, and you know all the stuff that comes with 130, 140 kids.
The Golden Eagles High School Marching Band from Trumbull, Connecticut, performs every weekend from early September through November. This year, the parents raised $10,000 for that trailer to help with all of the hauling. And they kept the big rig a secret from their kids until now. This is the day the band travels to New Jersey to compete in a national marching band championship.
Oh, yeah!
My name's Will Natick.
And what are you in the band?
I'm the center snare drum.
Tonight you're going to the Nationals. How excited are you?
We're so excited. We've been working hard every day, every practice. We're going to put all our effort into it and do it up.
What does working hard mean?
Coming to practice with pride, attitude, and concentration, focus.
On this day, the band was getting ready for a relatively short 3-hour practice before their big competition that night. The color guard warmed up by tossing flags, sabers, and wooden rifles.
Cool, you threw up a gun, a rifle, flipped it around in the air, and caught it snap like that. Sounds cool.
Thank you.
What's your name?
Gia Vidiello.
And what's the hardest part about the gun?
It hurts, but it's worth it.
It hurts your hands when you catch it?
Yeah, but it's worth when you get everyone's reaction to it.
One, two, one, two.
The brass tune their instruments for the November chill. They're reminded to point the bells of their horns up high toward the stadium lights so that judges in the stands can see and hear them better. This isn't your ordinary high school marching band. There's a coach for every section.
Make sure that's together, please.
There's a mini orchestra on the sidelines with marimbas, gongs, an electric guitar, and keyboards. And other percussionists are rolled out onto the field on floats, all part of a program titled Metal, a 4-part musical and marching homage to all things metallic.
Hey, Will.
Twins. Really nice shot at the arrival, 4 before letter C. Very nice overall tone. Very good energy throughout. Thank you.
My name is Kevin Lamb.
And you are?
The music supervisor.
And you have to make sure that these kids sound like one band.
Essentially, yeah, we're just trying to make sure that we don't have any people or individuals sticking out of the texture, so we want to make sure that everyone's contributing the same amount and then balancing between the different parts of the band. We got the pit in the front, we got the winds, and then we got the drum line in the back, so it's pretty important that we get all that evenly balanced.
Check! Adjust! Goodbye!
Okay, winds, thank you for...
There are three students who lead the band from three platforms placed along the sidelines.
Okay, I'm going to climb up on one of these stands here. Hi there. Tell me what your name is.
Michael Collins.
And what are you doing standing up here?
I'm the drum major of the band. I conduct.
And you're wearing white gloves. Why?
It's just so they're easier to follow. We wear sort of darker clothing and then white gloves so it's easier to see our hands.
Ooh, clever. All right, I won't stop you. Keep going.
Set!
Brass instructor Josh Murphy brought me onto the field into the brass section to experience the controlled chaos.
Air breathe. We're going this way.
All right, we're walking through the field and their brass is running past us and I'm being told to kneel with the brass. Okay.
Hey, bells up, lights.
They have to be athletes.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of breathing at the right times and running around. This is Kevin, who just started tuba this year.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
So what's the hardest thing about being a tuba player in a band? Marching.
Well, you need to have a lot of air to play the instrument first, and then also a lot of, what is it? Concentration, strength. Yeah, a lot of strength.
Set before where we have that arc that didn't form particularly well that time. We have to finish that set before we run to here. Yes.
My name is Adam Twombly. This is my second year working with the band.
Stand by, please.
I'm a music and visual instructor.
The players are doing a lot of choreography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Describe some of the things they're doing.
Yeah, that's the kind of the direction that this sort of activity is moving in these days. I had one instructor when I marched in drum corps. He used to say, it's the 21st century. We can't just march around and play music anymore. So there's a lot more dance and choreography that gets involved.
Wow.
Instead of just marching and playing.
So they're doing things like standing on one foot, leaning, lunging.
Yeah.
So you have to be a musician and really a kind of a dancer, a mover here.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me what your name is.
My name's Gretchen D'Amato.
And what do you play?
I play alto saxophone.
And there's a lot of movement that you have to do. You're not just playing the saxophone.
No, it's really hard.
How is it hard?
You have to be in time with everyone else, and you have to connect to the rest of the entire band all the way across the field. So.
And I saw you rubbing your knee just now.
Yeah, I twisted it.
Winds, hurry up, over here.
Peter Horton has been band director at Trumbull High for 29 years. He knows all of the tricks.
When you're moving this circle, okay, you have to place your foot smoothly. Okay, we're still getting people that are lunging into their heel. You can't. You have to think about walking on eggs. You've got to float. Put your foot in, roll to the toe, and that whole thing will sell 100% better. All right, try it this time.
All right. What are you trying to get them to do?
Their presence there. It's a soft, lyrical section. So, you want it to be nice and smooth and so forth.
Here they go again.
Yeah.
Band members were not only going to the national championships that night, they were also waiting to hear if they'd be picked to march in President-elect Donald Trump's inaugural parade.
How'd that go?
Good run.
All right.
glad. I'm good. I'm so out of breath, running around.
McKenna Churchick has been part of the color guard for 4 years.
The last six sets, I'm just like sprinting across the field.
With a flag.
Yeah, just like going, you know.
Are you excited about possibly going to the inaugural?
I am so excited.
Is there any talk in the band about like going to the inaugural when it's like a controversial kind of thing?
Yeah, everyone's like a little scared. You never know, there might be like a riot there or something.
Oh golly, I hope not.
But, yeah, me too, to be honest.
Yeah, no, this is, but it's very exciting.
Yeah, no, it's so exciting. Such a great opportunity.
That night, the Trumbull High School Golden Eagles marching band took first place at the U.S. Band's Open Class National Championships. And in a few weeks, they'll hear whether they'll be marching in the inaugural parade. For Here and Now, I'm Lynn Menegon. And you can see video of the Golden Eagles at hereandnow.org.
Since the election, Facebook, Google, and others have been grappling with a big question: how to tamp down on fake news that can catch like wildfire on their platforms, and which some believed helped hand the White House to Donald Trump. Now, some of the big companies in Silicon Valley have come up with new ways to identify fake news and to root it out, but that could be complicated, both technically speaking and philosophically. Here to break that down is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media at Recode. He's with us from San Francisco. Hey, Kurt, welcome back.
Hi, Peter.
So after the election, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook CEO, said it was crazy to say that fake news on his platform could have helped sway the election. But it does seem like he is more engaged on the issue now. What has changed?
I think he's realized that there's been a lot of backlash from folks in the media, but also his own users, that people do believe that fake news had a big role in this election, and Facebook is one of the places that distributes more news than anybody. And so I think at first, I think it was even 2 or 3 days after the election, he kind of dismissed the idea. And then when he realized that people weren't going to give it up, he said, OK, well, here's how we're actually going to go about and try and fix this. And he outlined a little bit of a game plan for that.
I do want to get to that, but I just want to throw out some fascinating statistics. A BuzzFeed found that the top 20 posts from established news sites had more than 1 million fewer shares, reactions, and comments on social media than the top posts from fake news sites did. And the New York Times, we mentioned this yesterday on the program, did this case study about a false tweet that was shared 16,000 times on Twitter and 350,000 times on Facebook. So, Kurt, I mean, it seems like at this point we've sort of reached the point where it is impossible to say that this isn't a problem.
I agree. I mean, it's hard to look at those numbers and say the things that are not true are spreading wider and farther than the things that are true. Clearly, that is an issue, and I think that is why, ultimately, Zuckerberg decided to say, well, we're going to come up with a game plan.
Okay, so that game plan, Zuckerberg has come out with a couple bullet points. I'll name a few of them. Adding a warning label to stories that users have flagged as inaccurate. Working with more third-party fact-checking organizations. What else is there?
The idea of kind of eliminating the business model behind fake news, so either not enabling those sites to advertise on Facebook, or I believe in Google's case, what they said was they said, we're not going to surface the ads that we sell on your site. So in other words, we're not going to fill the ad inventory you have, and therefore it's going to make it harder for you to make money. So I think the big issue, though, and you kind of alluded to this at the very beginning, is that it's not just a technical challenge, right? I mean, it's not just about finding and removing the news. There is a philosophical challenge here about, is this the role of Facebook and Google? And that's what they're grappling with.
But let's spend another minute on the technical standpoint, though, because how hard is it to pull those things off that we just mentioned? I mean, policing ads online, is that just a matter of a coder going in and figuring it out easily? Or does that take a lot of manpower, time, money?
I think the ad stuff would probably be relatively easy. I think the challenge, although I am of the mindset that Facebook and Google employ the smartest folks in the world when it comes to AI, artificial intelligence, machine learning, that kind of stuff. basically what that means is they should be able to write algorithms or code that can go in and detect when certain stories are spreading information that we know to be false. I think that they could do it technically. Again, I think the question that they're grappling with is, should they do it?
Yeah, it's tough. Philosophically speaking, again, they're in a bit of a bind because, as Facebook points out, it doesn't want to be policing the sharing of ideas on the internet or in this country. That's something that we sort of pride ourselves on, right? You can say what you want, and it's up to the person you're saying it to sort of do some of the work to have a conversation with you or to fact check it or something like that.
Right. I mean, is it their role, right, to determine what's true and what's not? And that's what Facebook is currently arguing right now, is they're saying, what is truth, right? And I don't know if that's a fair thing for us to give them a pass on, given the fact that 66% of folks get either some news or news headlines from Facebook. And so the headlines thing is concerning too, right? It only takes an inaccurate headline for people to think that they're getting a full story when really they're not. And so Facebook has always argued, hey, we're not a media company. Yeah. We're just a technology platform where everything can exist and people can see what they want. But the real reality is that they make money by taking our attention, directing it towards either videos or news or whatever, and then making money off of that. I think that is a media company.
Yeah. At what point do we start calling Facebook a news organization?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on who you are. I mean, I have a colleague of mine, Peter Kafka, who covers media very closely, and he's already written as much, right? And I agree with him. I think that Facebook very much is a media organization at this point, and they even in some instances pay media organizations to make live video for them. So it's just a matter of, when does, Facebook admit that? Will they ever admit that? I don't know. Yeah. And it doesn't, matter if they're labeled as such. It just matters how they behave, right? So now do they start to actually look into this fake news stuff and take responsibility to weed it out?
Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. Kurt, thanks as always.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.